Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable. Between now and 4 o'clock, as part of Faith Explored, every Saturday afternoon I'm joined by guests from a variety of different perspectives who talk about faith, life, belief, apologetics, the scriptures, history, philosophy, science, you name it. We cover it on this programme. And we've got a really interesting edition of the programme coming up today as we look at the question of animal suffering. And I'll be introducing my guests on that topic in just a moment's time. Well, if you're listening later on in today's schedule, you'll be hearing the profile between 4 and 5. Krishkan Dyer is the subject of today's interview, and he's going to be talking about his recent transition to the London School of Theology, where he's become the new principal. And he's going to be talking about his life and faith and what an interesting faith journey he's had. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 on the profile today. Don't forget that Unbelievable is available to listen back to if you'd like to catch up on past shows, including last week's on the Orthodox Church. Then do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can also subscribe to the podcast there and find videos as well. We've been putting up lots of videos from Unbelievable, the conference recently, not just last year's, but previous years as well. So premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And continued apologies to those who have been experiencing any disruption in their podcast feed. We are getting that sorted out. Some people who are subscribed for somewhat technical reasons are not seeing all the shows, and we're aiming to get that sorted as soon as possible. But we'll have plenty of your thoughts on the last few weeks of programming towards the end of today's program as well. So I hope you can keep listening towards the end of today's show to hear what you thought of recent shows on the Orthodox Church, Paschal's Wager, abortion, and more. Right now, though, let's get into the subject of today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the show, we're debating animal suffering. Now, does the existence of millennia of death and suffering in the animal kingdom down the ages count as evidence against a benevolent creator God? Well, my Christian guest today is Michael J. Murray. He's a philosopher by background, and he's executive vice president of programs at the John Templeton Foundation. Well, in the past, Michael's written a number of books, including Nature, Red in Tooth and Claw, Theism and the Problem of Animal Suffering. And there he presents a defence against the problem of animal suffering being at odds, let's say, with the existence of a good creator God. And part of that book focused on the type of pain that animals feel, and we'll come to that later on. Phil Harper is our non-believing guest today. He's known online as Skydive Phil. Well, he made something of a name for himself, creating a number of responses to William Lane Craig and how he presented Michael Murray's material around the issue of animal suffering in a debate that I actually hosted between William Lane Craig and atheist philosopher Stephen Law 3 years ago now, believe it or not, in central London. So today on the show, with that sort of as the peg on which we're doing this, we're going to be discussing whether animal suffering does present a problem for belief in God and the specific issue of what is the nature of animal pain. And we're going to meet both my guests who join me on the programme today. First of all, I'll introduce you, Michael, joining us on the line from the States. Thank you for being with me. How did you get into discussing these particular issues around the nature of animal suffering and so on that you wrote in your 2008 book?
That's a great question. You know, it's I had been teaching philosophy at Franklin and Marshall College here in Pennsylvania for 20 years and was teaching an upper-level seminar on the problem of evil, and had never really given this problem any consideration. And one of the students raised the question of how one could account for the problem of animal suffering, especially in light of evolution. Mm. And I said, you know, it's interesting because none of the typical theodicies apply, seemingly, at least apparently. And but I'm sure there must be many things written on this. So I'm going to go take a look, and I'm going to report back to you in the next seminar session. And I looked and I couldn't find anything and thought, okay, maybe this is a problem that deserves more scrutiny.
Okay, so if there wasn't a book to refer to, you thought you'd write one on it. Well, we'll come to that. Just give us a brief background to yourself, though, Michael. Did you sort of grow up in a sort of Christian environment? What's the story as far as your own personal beliefs?
Yeah, no, I did not, actually. I grew up in a family that was nominally Catholic, but we really were not devout in any way. We rarely attended religious services. And by the time I was in my mid-teen years, I was a pretty convinced atheist, and not only convinced, but evangelistic atheist. So I would try to harass my religious friends and their parents and present arguments to them that I thought were persuasive defending atheism. But in the last year of my time in high school, I met somebody who's now been a lifelong friend. Wouldn't let me off the hook so easily. We worked together for a full summer, and every day he'd come and prepared to share a variety of different arguments and evidences with me, and I'd go home and come back the next day to try to refute him. And at the end of,
sounds
at
like
the
end an of edition the, of this show almost, but played out
yeah,
over
the whole summer.
Summer.
So it could be a 4 month long episode. But but in the end, I actually was convinced that the Christian faith was true and became a Christian.
And did that sort of introduction to the faith in a way set you on this course for being a philosopher interested in these kind of intellectual issues surrounding it?
Yeah, I did, because I was intellectually curious as an atheist and as a Christian, I wanted to continue to examine these issues. I didn't have an intention to go into philosophy professionally when I entered college, but a couple years in, I found myself interacting with people in the philosophy department there, none of whom were theists, some of whom were atheists, one of whom was, like my former self, quite an evangelistic atheist. And I remember having a conversation with him one day. He said, one of my goals is to have every one of my students leave my class as an atheist.
Wow.
And that's what I said. I actually don't remember much of anything that happened after that because I was so stunned by the comment. I didn't know of any professor on my campus at the time who was a religious believer. And I thought it's conspicuous that there aren't any folks like that in the academy. And I thought it would be profitable to have some more of them around. So it was really at that juncture I decided I wanted to get a PhD in philosophy and have an opportunity to teach at a secular institution, just to present another voice in the conversation.
It almost sounds like the plot of that God's Not Dead film that came out earlier
you
in the
know,
year.
It's so funny because a number of people who saw that film, in fact, the first time someone saw a trailer, they emailed me and said, I think they made a story about your life. because actually, this professor did challenge me to come and take one of his classes.
Oh, really?
That is to present in one of his classes.
Yeah.
And it turned into quite an occasion. Other faculty showed up, and it was quite a circus, actually.
Did he come down on bended knee in the end, or we didn't?
No, that's
the
question
I
always get. I always get that question. And at the end of the course session, one of the students said, "So, Professor, were you convinced?" And he said, "Not yet, no." And actually, interestingly, I went to Franklin & Marshall as an undergraduate, and when I finished my degree, they happened to have a position open in my area of specialization, so they hired me back, and I ended up becoming, I like to tell people, I became department chair and ultimately became this fellow's boss. And and every semester, he would invite me into his class to talk to the students, and we ended up having a very good relationship.
Well, speaking of that film, I'm actually going to be speaking in a future episode of Unbelievable to the man behind it, Rice Brooks. We look forward to that. But anyway, thank you for that introduction. Fascinating stuff. We're having this is a dialogue, of course, as we always do on Unbelievable. And Phil Harper is my non-believing guest. Phil, welcome along to the program today.
Thank you, Justin. It's a real honour to be on the show because I listen to it religiously, quite frankly. So it's very exciting to be on the show, and thank you, Michael.
Well, you got in touch with me a little while back saying, I think this would make an interesting subject, talking about animal suffering. But before we get into some of that, your own background, quickly. We sort of had a discussion before we came into the studio about whether you'd call yourself an atheist or not. And you said, it's complicated. How would you define yourself if you had to?
Well, I think atheist is a fair term, because I would say I'm a negative atheist, but a lot of Christians call a negative atheist an agnostic.
Right.
So I don't believe in God, but that doesn't mean I think for sure there is no God.
Okay.
I just think there's no evidence for it, so I don't believe it.
and rather than and negative atheist doesn't mean you're always down in the dumps. And
no, the alternative term is weak atheist. So I'm not sure that's a lot better.
That's any better. Yeah.
Anyway, not great terms I get to choose from.
You've never had a faith though. Or
I have. You have. I have. Okay. I was brought up in a sort of liberal Jewish household.
Okay.
And I was. My parents were very liberal Jews, but they sent me to the sort of local Hebrew school. And that was probably more Orthodox than they were. Oh, and I remember going on holiday, praying to God to forgive them for eating bacon. Don't crash the plane on the way back from holiday. I know they didn't mean to do anything wrong. Then I think in my teenage years, I gave up my faith. And probably the reason that would be, there's probably many reasons, but the one that's probably most relevant to this discussion was the Exodus. The Passover ceremony that we have to do every year, I have to sing in Hebrew this song called the Manish Tana, and it's asking the family to tell me the story of the Exodus. And at some point I just thought, it's really cruel, in particular because it's there's not just suffering to the Egyptians, the people, but their animals too. So if you take the 10th plague,
that's interesting. Yeah.
It isn't just the firstborn Egyptians that get killed, it's their cattle. And the first plague, there's the river turns into blood and all the fish die. And at some point in my life, I just went, this is terribly cruel. This cannot be the work of a benevolent God.
Well, that's interesting that it was the Exodus story that sparked that. But funnily enough, we're going to be picking up that whole issue about some of the Old Testament stories and so on in future episodes. So listen out for more on that. But that's not what we're here to discuss today. We're here to discuss what is can be, in a sense, quite a technical, philosophical issue. But we're hoping to break it out in a way that's hopefully accessible for as many people as possible on today's programme. To do that, we've got Phil here, we've got Michael as well. And as I've said, Michael is a philosopher by background, and his area that he's well known for, it came out in a book published a few years ago, Nature Red in Tooth and Claw, Theism and the Problem of Animal Suffering. And Michael, do you want to try and give us a flavour of what you were trying to do with that book, what the issue was that you were trying to address, and give us an idea of how you tried to address it in the book?
Sure. So there are actually different ways of thinking about the problem that I'm addressing in the book, but I think the most perspicuous way to put it is that I'm looking at whether or not there are whether or not we can resist or push back against an argument from evil that takes as its primary bit of evidence the pain, suffering, predation, death, extinction that we find in evolutionary history. It looks like it appears that those elements of the created order or of the cosmos are in some way instrumental to bringing about the complexity and diversity of life that we find on the earth. And for a theist who believes that God is the creator of all that is, that creates something of an uncomfortable position, because it looks like that those things are the instruments by which creation occurs. And I think that makes the problem of evil when it comes to animal suffering especially acute. So the question that I was asking in the book is, can we provide explanations which are sufficient to turn back that particular problem of evil? And there's more to say about that, because I think what counts as an explanation is not or the way we use the word explanation in the context of theodicy is not the way we oftentimes normally use that word in ordinary English discourse. So at some point it would be good for me to pause and explain
perhaps you could do that. I mean, just as I see it, in very basic terms, this issue is that if there have been millennia of animal sort of life and death cycle, and that has included lots of pain and suffering in the parts of many animals, you know, when they're eaten, when they suffer illnesses, or all manner of ways in which they could suffer. But that's part of the process by which God is using to bring about, you know, in the end, humans and life as we know it today, if you like. So some people say it's very wasteful. It's very cruel. If God could have created us as we are today, you know, by a click of the fingers, that would have circumvented that whole process. And why do we need it? And how can that be a good thing if we do believe in a good God? So, okay, just where did you start to kind of, you know, put a few pointers in here, and then I'll bring
sure.
villain?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the point that you just made, because it's one of the few things that actually young Earth creationists and the new atheists agree on.
Yes, it's often used as from a young Earth point of view, isn't it?
It's often used by young Earth creationists as a way of denying evolution, because they think there's no possible way that an all good God could have used evolution as the mechanism for creation, given the pain, suffering, death, and extinction that seems to attend that process. So, how did I begin? I'll answer that question in two ways. Actually, the first way I began was by taking a look at what Christian thinkers had to say in those years just after the publication of The Origin of Species. My suspicion was that there was a significant amount of reflection on this topic in that period, and it turns out that is actually correct. That's a story that really hasn't been told. So any PhD student doing history was looking for a topic, it would be a really interesting one to do. And I did refer to some of that literature in the book. If you're asking the question conceptually, I think the first thing I needed to get clear on was exactly what is required in order to provide an explanation sufficient to turn back the argument. And I'll just say quickly, because I think this is important for where we're headed in this discussion down the road, that an explanation for evil that's sufficient to turn back the argument from evil doesn't require that the components of that explanation are true or that you know them to be true. Mm-hmm. And what I was looking for were explanations that are such that we don't know them to be false. I'll just say simply, I think it's a bit more complicated than that. Okay. Explanations that we don't know to be false, which are such that if they were true, they would provide a good explanation. That is, they would explain to us what the morally sufficient reason might be for God's permitting such evils. And but in addition, one of the things I explored, and this is what's led to a lot of the controversy about the book, is trying to explore the phenomenon itself. So when we think about non-human animal, and by the way, I'll say animal pain and suffering from here on out, although what I mean by that is non-human animal.
Yeah, of course.
When we talk about animal suffering, one of the things we want to know is, well, what is that phenomenon exactly? Is it exactly analogous to what human beings experience when we experience what we call pain? And it turns out it's a difficult question to answer. So if it turns out that there is no such thing as pain attended by negative feeling in animals, then the problem goes away because there isn't a problem. But most of us agree that animals likely do experience negative feeling, conscious pain. And then the question is, well, are there good reasons for a good God to permit that to occur? Are there outweighing goods that require the permission of that evil? And what the book does is go through a variety of different candidates.
Yeah.
And I think there are a number of candidate explanations. They can't all be true because they're not even consistent with each other. And what I do is really, I think of this as a conversation starting book. Yeah. I'm pointing people in the direction of some possible answers and letting them explore them for themselves.
Okay. Give us kind of just an idea of one of the ones that you land on that you think is probably a good place to start that conversation.
Well, I'll pick one of the ones that's easier to explain. So if we think it's a good thing for there to be embodied organisms, then certain other things have to be true. There have to be mechanisms by which these organisms can protect themselves from bodily injury. Mm-hmm. And some have hypothesized that pain is necessary for organisms to protect themselves from bodily injury. Now, there's some initial objections to this, which might make you think, well, that's obviously false, because first of all, we know that there are organisms that can avoid injury, can respond to noxious or injurious stimuli in a way that's aversive but doesn't involve any pain because they don't have neural systems that are sufficiently complex. And I think that's right. However, if some of these organisms act on the basis of intentions, that is, they try to do things, they have goals and aspirations, then what it looks like organisms need is some kind of countervailing force that informs the organism of when the dangers to their bodily integrity are becoming so great that they're threatening their existence. Sometimes we need to know that we must stand down from trying to achieve a goal that we're trying to achieve for ourselves.
Yeah.
And there's some really interesting research that shows that ways of trying to prevent organisms from injuring themselves that don't involve pain in the end don't work. Because if you want something bad enough, you'll keep trying to get it despite the injury that it causes.
And complex nervous systems and so on are an important part of that whole process, I suppose.
That's correct. Yeah. And if animals act on intentions, and I think it's reasonable to think that they do, then they would need something similar. They just can't survive without it.
Well, look, you've spelt out things really nicely there for us. You've given us a flavour, at least, of one of the rebuttals that you would bring to this issue of why animal suffering is necessary. Going to bring in Phil in just a moment. If you're listening, though, and you'd like an input in this, you're more than welcome, as ever, to get in touch yourself about today's show. Do send an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Drop me a line there. You can leave a comment in the comments box underneath today's programme. You can also find the links to the Twitter and Facebook account and so on, and get in touch that way and follow the show. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we sort of had to take a little time there just to explain some of the issues at the outset, Phil. We're talking today about animal suffering. I know you want us to get to some of the kind of specifics about whether the nature of animal pain is different, but what's your general take on the issue of animal suffering? You said it kind of played into your own journey out of faith at one level. Do you still find it to be a compelling argument overall?
The thing is, you've got two questions. One, can I believe in God intellectually? But then also in Christianity and in Judaism, we're asked to love God. Mm. And I find it very hard to love a God that would allow so much suffering in animals. And I think Michael frames the problem very well, and I'd recommend everyone to read his book, because he's very eloquent in expressing the problem. But I think the response, you know, isn't quite adequate. In particular, so for if we take the last response, that animals need to have pain, that does, at first glance, seem very reasonable.
Sure.
But I think there's a few problems with it. The main problem is that there's not. And I think this is a theme in the book. We talk about pain as if there's just one thing called pain. But really, there are many, many different types of pain. So you have acute pain, which is the sort of pain you get when you put your hand on a hot stove. That's very rapid pain.
And makes you withdraw it immediately.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that is useful. Mm. And then, but after that, it still hurts. Sure. And then you have inflammatory pain. And that can also be useful. It helps you guard the injury. Mm-hmm. But often inflammation lasts longer than you really need it to. And that's why we take anti-inflammatory drugs. Sure, and we have diseases of inflammation. Mm. So arthritis is a disease of inflammation. Right. Mm. And then we get all kinds of other pains, which really don't seem to have any use whatsoever. So you have neuropathic pain, which is a damaged nervous system. There's one pain called complex regional pain syndrome number one. Mm. And this doctors can't find any physical cause for this pain. It's a mystery. Right. Mm. A friend of mine's just been diagnosed with dysthesia, which is very similar. Mm. You know, he's got terrible pain, and it's not like he can respond to it because he doesn't know what's causing it. Yeah. Similarly, I think we also have pains that would be useful, but that we don't have. So, for example, when you sit out in the sun and you're going to get burned, that doesn't hurt. Mm. You don't actually have any pain to radiation.
Until afterwards.
Exactly.
Right.
And gamma radiation, which could kill
perhaps,
it doesn't hurt.
Perhaps even pain retrospectively, though, can be helpful to remind you not to do it next time. Who knows?
If you take someone smoking, they don't feel the pain of their lungs being poisoned.
Until it's too
late. So we have all kinds of pains that seem completely useless. And we have lots of pains that would be really useful, but we don't have. And so I think the explanation there is missing that complexity of pain.
Do you want to come back on any of that, Michael?
Well, I mean, they're all really good points. I think, you know, these specific sorts of examples are typical when we think about the issue of the problem of evil more generally, because the question that it raises concerns the nature of design constraints. So here's what we don't know. Is it possible to design a nervous system that perfectly discriminates between signals phenomenally conscious pain in all and only circumstances where there is a noxious stimulus being applied? And actually, we don't know the answer to that question. Would we be better off if we were designed in such a way that when we tried to smoke, it caused pain? Well, I mean, you know, just from the armchair, you'd think, sure. But it just may be the case that the sorts of noxious stimuli involved there are such that a nervous system can't sufficiently discriminate those. Mm. That is, it may turn out that if you have that, then any time you walk down a street in Beijing, you'd feel, you know, overwhelming pain. And that's just that just wouldn't be adaptive for us. Mm. So we just don't know what some of those constraints are. I mean, you understand the illustration with Beijing, right? Just because the pollution in the air is sufficiently strong that it would be like smoking. So we have to figure out what the design constraints are that are realistic for organisms that live in the kind of environment that we have, and the kind of thing that Phil's describing might not be possible.
I mean, yeah, I guess we're dealing with hypotheticals at some level here. But I mean, is your overall point then, Michael, that it's plausible there could be justification for even the pipes of pain, which currently don't seem to have any particular helpful purpose?
Yeah, it may be that some of those pains don't have any purpose, but the permission of them still might be necessary, because the fact that we feel them might be a byproduct of design constraints that are that can't be controlled even by an omnipotent being. They're just constraints on how you can design physical things. And so it may be the case that in order to be sensitive to certain kinds of noxious stimuli, or to have a nervous system that's capable of registering those things, in some cases they'll misfire. There may be no way to prevent that except by, say, miraculous intervention or something like that.
Quick comeback on that, Michael.
Sure.
Phil even. Yes, getting my...
No problem. I think actually it would be quite useful to have... you sense some pain when you went into a very toxic environment. My wife and I, we like to explore volcanoes, and we get very close to them, and we always put on gas masks when we know there's, you know, some noxious steam coming out. And if you didn't know that, then you could be in trouble.
Sure.
I think the problem here, I think, with Michael's explanation is it sort of downgrades God's omnipotence, I think. You know, why couldn't he? If we're supposed to believe he's omnipotent, are we really to believe that he couldn't make a nervous system that didn't fail quite so much as it did?
Sure. I mean, many people at this point would turn to issues theological, I suppose, Michael, about the fact that we live in a fallen world at some level, which is kind of in some way not up to scratch in terms of our physical makeup and so on. And does that play in at all to the kind of explanations you bring to these issues?
That I bring?
Mm.
So one of the chapters I explore, let me just parenthetically pause for a minute and come back to the earlier question. So, and give you an illustration that's actually relevant to the question of evolutionary evil, I guess. So some people will say, well, look, wouldn't it be so evolution actually doesn't require death. All evolution requires is differential reproductive success and changing gene frequencies over time. So as long as some organisms can reproduce more successfully than others, evolution can occur. The ones that aren't as successful won't reproduce at the same rate. Ones that are successful will produce at a faster rate. And so you'll see differential reproductive success and changed gene frequencies over time. But nobody has to die. Mm. And so the question is, well, where does death come into the picture when it comes to evolution? And it's not a simple question to answer. But if I had to give a simple answer, I would say the answer is finitude. If you've got finite resources, that's when some of the organisms have to perish. They have to make way for the other ones. Mm. So you might say, well, look, in the abstract, why doesn't God just create an infinite plane with infinite resources on which all these organisms can exist? They can be immortal. They can evolve. They can move towards from simplicity to complexity, if you like that sort of language in the context of evolution. But the answer is, we have good reason to think that that's just not possible. That is, in a physical cosmos, you can't have an infinite plane because gravitational forces become too strong and all the organisms get squashed. You just have to have finitude. It's part of the natural consequence of the design constraints on a physical cosmos. And discerning what these constraints are is not something you can easily do from the armchair, and you might not be able to do it at all. But just to come back to the case in question here, when we think about design constraints in organisms, it's sometimes hard to know just what those constraints are. We wouldn't have known, for example, about the design constraint I just mentioned until quite recently in the history of our understanding of physics. Mm. Anyway, so come back to your question about...
We'll probably need to take a quick break first, and then we might get a chance to touch on that before we move into some of the other material we want to discuss on the programme today. But you're listening to a discussion on animal suffering today. And does the existence of millennia of death and suffering in the animal kingdom count as evidence against a benevolent creator God? And we're going to be talking about types of animal suffering as well in the next part of today's programme. So another episode to get you thinking here on Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. My Christian guest today is Michael J. Murray. He's a philosopher and he's the author of the book Nature Red in Tooth and Claw, defending the idea that animal suffering isn't necessarily at odds with the existence of a good God. Phil Harper is my non-believing guest, and we're going to be hearing more from both of them in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we assess the impact of what's been called the Christian Holocaust in Iraq, including a special interview with the Vicar of Baghdad, Canon Andrew White. I'm gay, but I'm still an evangelical. We speak to former worship leader Vicky Beeching about coming out. And popular preacher J. John gives a masterclass in how to make your sermons sparkle. All that, plus news, reviews, and your favourite columnists in the October edition.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Hello, welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley. Today on the show, we're debating animal suffering, not something we've really done ever on Unbelievable. We've certainly spoken about the issue of human suffering and whether that is an objection to the existence of God. But what about the animal kingdom? Does the existence of millennia of death and suffering count as evidence against a good creator God? Well, my two guests today are Michael Murray. He's a philosopher by background, and he's written a book on this, and it created some controversy a few years ago when William Lane Craig, a well-known Christian philosopher, used one of his arguments in a debate that I hosted between him and atheist philosopher Stephen Law. We're going to hear that and how it relates to today's discussion in just a moment's time. And the man who sort of, you know, created some noise around that at the time and since is Phil Harper, our atheist guest. We've decided to go for atheist, I think, rather than negative, weak or strong or positive or whatever. But in any case, you're a non-believer, Phil, and you've been sort of interacting with Michael as to whether there could be good reasons for a creator God to allow pain and suffering in the animal kingdom. So we'll come back to that in a moment's time. If you enjoy these kinds of discussions, then why not go online and check out the vast archive of past programmes on Unbelievable. Thousands of people download the podcast every week, and you could join them too. PremierChristianRadio.com if you want to go to the main website, ad/Unbelievable, to find the Unbelievable webpage where you can find all the resources, links and much more to the podcast, and indeed links to the Unbelievable Conference DVD from earlier in the year. If you haven't yet ordered your copy, what are you waiting for? It's available there, all the links and so on. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. Well, returning to our issue today of animal suffering, and we were hearing just in that last section Michael giving again something of a defense of how, why death, for instance, might be a necessary part of the type of creation that God sort of, as it were, is constrained within, in a sense. And we don't live in a world of infinite resources, and that inevitably entails that there is a death process. Death, I guess, involves pain, is part of the cycle we're talking about. How do you respond to those kinds of issues, which take us to quite a sort of metaphysical level, really?
Sure. Well, we actually, on our YouTube channel, we have also a cosmology series called Before the Big Bang, and we interview a lot of the top cosmologists, inventor of loop quantum gravity, inventor of string theory, and so on. And we haven't addressed this on camera, but we have asked them, well, do you think the universe is spatially infinite? And my impression is that most cosmologists think that it probably is spatially infinite. So I'm not convinced of this argument. The gravitational attraction should just balance out. No one's ruled. I recommend anyone go on any physics FAQ and type in, is the universe infinite? And virtually, I think every response will be, we don't know. But the evidence certainly looks like maybe it is. So I'm not. And also, of course, if you believe in heaven, then surely there is a logical possibility, at least, of having no problem with finite resources,
and or the end of death in that sense as well. Which is
indeed,
sort of
isn't
what,
it supposed to? You know, I'm not
promises at some level.
I'm not too familiar with Christian theology, but if I'm right, maybe you can correct me. In the future, here on Earth, this sort of scenario will actually play out.
It does kind of bring us back to that question that which I did ask Michael, and I don't know if you've sort of had thoughts on this, but people sometimes say, well, the fact that we have a system that involves death and suffering is an aspect of the fall, however you, you know, define that.
Well, according to those who think that natural evil is to be explained in terms of a fall, the idea is that there's some primeval couple, some initial pair of Homo sapiens who committed some moral wrongdoing. And in virtue of that, the creation is, you might say, broken. And the natural evil that we find in the world, including animal pain and suffering and death and extinction, are all to be explained in terms of that, the wrongdoing of that pair and its consequences. But because so much pain and suffering and death and predation seems to predate, predate the existence of any Homo sapiens, it's hard to see how that explanation might work.
Sure.
I will say, you know, there are some who say, Alvin Plantinga, for example, has famously or infamously speculated that perhaps the explanation for natural evil is not the wrongdoing of some initial pair of Homo sapiens, but of some preternatural beings, the fall of Satan, for example. You know, some people think that's just completely fantastic and unbelievable. Others don't think so. But I mean, were there such a fall and were it to have such consequences for nature, you know, perhaps that would be an explanation. But I will say, and I mentioned this in the book, you know, I do think creating a cosmos that has what I call that sort of fragility, that is, its integrity depends on the moral wrongdoing of one or a pair of creatures, itself seems to be a defect of creation. And I think that's something that's hard for fall theorists to explain.
Sure. Well, we won't go down that rabbit hole too much right now, because I do want us to move into other areas. And perhaps what would be helpful at this point is to play a little bit of the debate that took place a few years ago now. And this was when Christian philosopher William Lane Craig was over in the UK, and I was hosting some of the legs of his Reasonable Faith tour. And we started off in London. It was a debate on the existence of God between him and atheist philosopher Stephen Law. Well, if you want to hear the full thing, you can, of course, go back in the Unbelievable archives. I'll make sure there's a link with the show that gets you there as well. But this is just a very brief snippet where in one of his rebuttals to Stephen Law, Stephen Law had brought up the issue of animal pain and suffering during the course of the debate. This was when William Lane Craig referenced some of Michael Murray's work and why it might be that when it comes to animal pain, things aren't quite as clear as they seem. Here's what he had to say.
Now, let me say one other thing, however, that is a result of recent scientific discoveries that shed remarkable light on the problem of animal suffering. In his book, Nature Red in Tooth and Claw, published by Oxford University Press, Michael Murray explains that there is really a threefold hierarchy of pain awareness. On the most fundamental level, there is simply the reaction to stimuli, such as an amoeba exhibits when you poke it with a needle. It doesn't really feel pain. There's a second level of pain awareness, which sentient animals have, which is an experience of pain. And animals like horses, dogs, and cats would experience this second-level pain awareness. But they do not experience a third-level pain awareness, which is the awareness of second-order pain. That is, the awareness that one is himself in pain. For that sort of pain awareness requires self-awareness. And this is centered in the prefrontal cortex of the brain, a section of the brain that is missing in all animals except for the higher primates and human beings. And therefore, even though animals are in pain, they aren't aware of it. They don't have this third-order pain awareness. They are not aware of pain, and therefore they do not suffer as human beings do. Now, this is a tremendous comfort to those of us who are animal lovers like myself or to pet owners. Even though your dog or your cat may be in pain, it really isn't aware of being in pain, and therefore it doesn't suffer as you would when you are in pain.
There you go. So you heard some of the debate there, and that was William Lane Craig speaking about the nature of suffering and animal suffering in particular, that and drawing on some of Michael Murray's work. So let's come to you first of all, Phil, because it was on the back of this that you started to engage and post some videos, and then there were responses online from William Lane Craig and so on. What was your fundamental issue with what Bill outlined there?
Well, there's so many problems with that statement. I think to coin a phrase, you know, if you were to hand that into a science class, it would have a big red pen all the way through it. So problem number one is that it's just not true that higher primates, or as Michael's put in his book, humanoid primates, are the only ones to have a prefrontal cortex. If you watch our video, go online, go into YouTube, search "Can animals suffer skydive fail?" We document that very extensively. I'll just give you one example right now. This is an email we got from the author of the most cited text in the world on the prefrontal cortex, the textbook called Prefrontal Cortex by Joaquin Fuster. And he said, this is his email, their statement is wrong on several counts. One, anatomy. He said there's three criteria and they're met by all mammals and even some birds. And on physiology, he says the principal function of the prefrontal cortex as a whole is a temporal coordination of goal-directed sequences of action. These criteria are met by all mammals and some birds. So it's just wrong for a starter. But then there's some other problems with it as well. This notion that you need to have a human level of self-awareness to have experience of pain, I think, is mistaken. You know, we can talk about there's lots of different levels of self-awareness. It's not a binary thing. You either have it or you don't. And there have been people that have tried to associate the prefrontal cortex, but not just the prefrontal cortex, there's many other structures in the brain. The insula, ACC, I won't bore you with what they are. But actually a recent study on someone called patient R had all of those areas damaged, and they tested his self-awareness, and he seemed to pass all the tests. So it looks like what the scientists in our video said was really self-awareness is much more likely to be from the whole brain. And it also ignores another problem called cognitive resilience. So cognitive resilience is the idea that if you lose some part of your neuroanatomy, another part can actually take over. And we actually see this in evolutionary space as well. So, for example, in the corvid brain, corvids are birds like crows, ravens, magpies. They have a structure called the nidopallium caudal atrial. I hope I pronounced that right. Anyway, so this structure is actually known, and I invite your listeners to Google avian prefrontal cortex. It's known.
If you never have, now's your chance. Done it,
So what neuroanatomists think is that this structure is quite different to the human prefrontal cortex, or the mammalian prefrontal cortex, but it actually plays the same function.
Okay.
And what that tells you is that evolution can go via different routes to the same function. And also with pain perception, it's not the prefrontal cortex that most people associate it with. It's actually another structure called the anterior cingulate cortex. But the problem here is actually when it's very hard to image pain because everyone's pain is slightly different and there's different types of pain as we discussed. Now, there was a recent attempt to do this in 2013, and the paper lists many, many different areas of the brain that they said, okay, this is just for heat pain, and they didn't even mention the prefrontal cortex. And another problem is you have there was another procedure that blocked a known pain pathway, and it worked. The patients didn't feel pain after that, but that was for a while, and then the pain came back because the pain found another pathway.
Well, obviously lots there, and some of it quite complex in its way, but the overall point is you felt that that didn't represent accurately the situation that's going on when it comes to animal pain, that A, their prefrontal cortex exists in lots of different types of animal, and B, you don't necessarily need to even have a traditional one to have this kind of awareness of pain. And I think Bill kind of comes back and talks about the sense of, he's not saying animals don't experience pain, but it's about whether they're conscious in the way that we are conscious of being in pain.
Well, I think Michael in his book said very clearly that this argument is a neo-Cartesian argument.
Let's ask Michael to comment. And now I'm not asking you, Michael, obviously, to necessarily defend Bill's particular take on your argument. But in general, you're aware of the kind of, some of the online toing and froing that went on around this. And in fact, you contributed an article on Bill's blog in sort of response to this issue. What are you prepared to say, in a sense? And I know this was only actually a small part of your book, which kind of has become a big issue for some people. But what were you saying in the book about the nature of animal pain and how much they are or aren't aware of the pain they're in?
Sure. So let me first of all reiterate something you just said, that I did post a reply to Phil's videos on Bill's blog. He had asked me to provide that. And the title of the article is Animal Pain Revisited. So if you want to look at it, you can see the details.
I'll make
sure
there's a link to that from today's program.
And so I can't go through the whole thing in detail, but let me emphasize, first of all, that you're right. The neuroanatomical claim is a very, very small, in fact, not even necessary part of the argument. What I think the listeners should know, however, is that definition of the prefrontal cortex is there are just two different definitions, and there's a more common one and then there's a more traditional one. So the more common one is a functional one, according to which the prefrontal cortex is a projection zone from a from another part of the brain. And if you take that as the definition of a prefrontal cortex, then it's certainly true that non-primates have it. But the traditional definition, which I say traditional not to indicate that it has a higher status or something, because it's not as commonly used today, is to define the prefrontal cortex as a certain part of the cortical of the human cortex that has a particular kind of cell type associated with it. So they call it the granular caudal layer 4. And it's not used as commonly these days as a way of describing what the prefrontal cortex is, but that is something that's distinctive to humanoid primates. Now, set that aside for a minute. What's the argument? And here was the claim, and actually most of the claims that I'm making here are not very controversial from the standpoint of contemporary philosophy of mind. So there are different kinds of consciousness. One kind, sometimes called access consciousness, where the idea is an organism has an awareness of things in its environment and therefore can do things like navigate successfully in that environment. But there's a second kind of consciousness that involves an awareness of those things in the environment that has a feel to it. Sometimes we call it phenomenal consciousness. So, you know, it's very commonly cited patients with blind sight. These are individuals who claim to be blind. They claim they can't see anything, but you can put them into a hallway or a room with obstacles, and they can successfully navigate around all those obstacles. So the question is, what's the conscious state of those people? And the answer is, I mean, you might ask the question, do they see or not? And the answer is, well, yeah, they see in the sense that they have they're registering the presence of things in their environment by a visual medium, but they don't know that they can see it. Right? It doesn't feel like anything to them to see it. Right? So that's phenomenal consciousness. And the question is, what does it take in order to have that? And the answer is, we don't know for sure. One of the more popular theories out there is called higher order theories of consciousness, where phenomenal consciousness requires that you have a higher order thought of a first order mental state, which is what provides you with your access consciousness. And many people who defend higher order theories of consciousness claim that the prefrontal cortex plays an important role in mediating higher order thought. And if that's right, then if you lack that, it looks like you don't have phenomenal consciousness. You can have access consciousness, but you can't have phenomenal consciousness. So is that the way it is for animals? I think we just don't know.
We don't
sure.
know. And in a sense, then you've laid out some possibilities, some potential ways in which the nature of animal brains generally differ from human brains could mean that you alleviate to some extent the issue of how much pain they actually are aware of in the same manner.
That's right.
But you wouldn't, you're certainly not staking your thesis on this, obviously.
That's right. And as Phil points out, you know, we know lots about neuroplasticity. We know that just because something plays a particular function in the neuroanatomical component of one organism, doesn't necessarily mean that same function is mediated by the same. By the same region in the brain in another organism, or even that within the same organism, the same function can't be mediated by different portions. We know that even in human beings.
Well, let's allow Phil to come back then, just quickly as
okay. So many things to say. we won't have time to go over everything. First off, on the definition of the prefrontal cortex, even if you go with the most restricted definition, it can't support the case, because what Michael said was that it, in his book, was only humanoid primates, and he specifically says that only goes back 10 million years. Well, even if you went to the most restricted possible definition, you would still have monkeys, which would go back, 35 million years. It's not millennia of suffering. It's tens of millions of years of suffering. So that simply can't help the argument at all. With respect to language, I think if you're going to stand up in front of thousands of people, and many more online, of course, and say that animals don't experience because they don't have the prefrontal cortex, you've got to use contemporary language, of course, and you should hint at, there's some controversy about what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, if I said, Michael Murray and William Lane Craig were having a gay affair, it would not be a defence to say, in the 1930s, a gay affair just meant they're throwing a party. Yeah, it was a happy evening. Yeah. You know, you've got to use contemporary language. And in contemporary language, there's widespread agreement that all mammals have a prefrontal cortex. Now, coming on to the issue of blindsight, I actually spoke to Larry Weizkrantz, who is the discoverer of blindsight. And when he discovered this claim was out there, he invited me up to Oxford and said, I want to help you mount a defence against this because it's completely implausible that blind sight is like animal pain. And I won't have too much time to go over why, but basically blind sight wasn't discovered in humans. It was discovered in monkeys first, and then they found a patient. And he said it was also discovered in rats. Now, if animal pain is like blind sight, then what you would, if animals lack this phenomenal consciousness, what you would expect is the blind-sighted animals wouldn't have any difference to the normal-sighted animals, but they do. And in particular, I think the issue is animals make motivated pain responses. So if you shock a crab in its shell, it will give up its shell, something it needs for its survival. And you can see these sort of pain versus quality of shell trade-offs, how much it's going to get. And a blind-sighted person is not going to give up resources to avoid an unpleasant visual stimuli or pay for resources to go and, you know, look at art in an art gallery. And we have enormous amount of evidence. I don't know if you'll give me any time to explain I'm sure we're running out of it. But there's an enormous amount of evidence, if you can give me a 2 minutes or whatever, to say that animals do have what we really need is emotional pain. And in fact, one of Michael's sources was Bob Berman, and he said that exact thing. Animals need to have emotions to feel pain. That's really the key issue. So what evidence do we have that animals have emotions? Well, we can actually see that from looking at humans that don't have a cerebral cortex at all. So there's a condition called hydrocephaly. And Antonio Damasio is one of the top neuroscientists in the world. Again, someone Michael quoted. He examined these patients, and he actually changed his mind about what's needed for emotions, because he did argue, I think, that the cortex was needed. But let me read you from his latest book, Self Comes to Mind. He's talking about these patients, and he says, "It is compelling for me to assume that the delight they exhibit is real felt delight. The condition gives lie to the claim that sentience, feeling, and emotion arise only out of the cerebral cortex. That cannot possibly be the case." He's not saying, you know, it might not be the case. It cannot possibly be the case. And the sort of study of the neuroscience of emotions is called affective neuroscience. The most cited textbook on this is by Jack Panskep. And I invite people to maybe go on his TED talk. And he'll tell you that emotions come not from the cortex, but from subcortical regions. They've discovered sort of 7 subcortical regions. If you stimulate these electrically in a human being, that you get the emotion. And then if you stimulate that same region in a rat, you get the same emotion. But then what we really want to know is, does the animal like or dislike the emotion? How can you possibly tell that? And I think that's the problem Michael's trying to allude to. And you can do that. The way you can do that is you actually give the animal control of the stimulation. And what you find is when you give it the stimulation, let's say a negative emotion, then it will always switch that stimulation off. Right. Whereas if you give it a positive stimulation, it will keep stimulating until it drops dead from exhaustion.
I mean, this is an interesting aspect of this, whether the emotion that attends a particular feeling of pain, say, is important in whether we're talking about the same thing. And I don't know, Michael, if you're happy to agree or disagree there with Phil and the way he sees that this is something shared across the animal kingdom, not just among humans.
Well, so I'm just going to say, I'm actually aware of the evidence that Phil's raising. The problem is, the reason I'm still uncertain, it's not that I'm skeptical, I just think I don't have sufficient reason to accept the view that he's describing, is the following. All of these inferences that Phil and lots of other people who work in animal behavior and animal cognition make are based on behavioral responses on the part of the organism. And we all know that having aversive reactions to noxious stimuli of various sorts is adaptive. That's why organisms have the ability to sense pain, to sense noxious stimuli, and to react aversively to it. The question is, what sort of internal mental states attend that? And you might say, well, I can just infer that by looking at their behavior, right? If the rat hits the lever more times or stops hitting it, that's obviously because it feels pleasure or pain. That's the part I don't agree with. I mean, it's adaptive for them to behave in certain ways in the presence of certain kinds of stimuli. The question is, what's the internal phenomenally conscious state that attends that? And how do we know that it's there?
Yeah.
And the answer is, that's a very difficult question to answer.
And it's underdetermined by the evidence as far as you're concerned. You can't say one way or the other exactly what's going on there with
that's
animal.
Right. Yeah. But let me just throw in one other thing, because I think maybe all the fuss about the prefrontal cortex is overblown. So the way I come to this in the book is to look at the process of lobotomy. It was, you know, in the 1940s, and they use this as a procedure to try to resolve a variety of different kinds of neurological disorders. And what they essentially do is take an ice pick, stick it in through your eye, and move it around in various ways.
Not very nice, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can see videos of this online. It's pretty gruesome.
I'd rather not, to be honest, but yeah.
Don't watch it.
and then essentially see what happens. And in some cases, for patients who had chronic pain, when they did this, they found that the patients still said that they experienced phenomenally conscious pain, but it didn't bother them. And that's a very odd description, I think, of their conscious condition. But in any case, what I was pointing out was, well, that portion of the brain that's being disrupted, call it whatever you want, is something that seems to mediate negative feeling of conscious pain. And so the question is, do non-human animals have that? And the answer is, I think it's really difficult to know. Now, that region anatomically is the one that we usually call the prefrontal cortex. But again, it's often described in functional terms these days, and that definition doesn't apply. I don't care what we call it, though. The question is, if non-human animals don't have that thing, the thing that was disrupted in the lobotomy, then they don't have negative field pain. That was really the substance of the claim.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and then we'll let Phil come back, and we'll just start to draw things together. We're talking about animal suffering today, getting quite philosophical, quite technical, biological, and I don't know whether this program is causing you pain or pleasure, but you can tell us. But it's great to have Michael Murray on, who's a noted philosopher in this area, and also Phil, who's here to ask some tricky questions of him. And we'll be back in just a moment's time as we conclude our discussion. Welcome back to today's programme. I'm Justin Brierley, here for the final part of Unbelievable, as we conclude the discussion in a moment's time on animal suffering and whether it presents a problem for the existence of a good creator God. And we're also going to be looking forward to hearing your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. I've got people like Bex, who got in touch to say she really enjoyed the Evangelicals and the Orthodox Church programme, and someone who said it was much higher quality than normal. A backhanded compliment, if ever I heard one. But anyway, some of your feedback coming up in just a moment's time to the programme. As I mentioned, later on this afternoon, you can hear Krish Kandaya on The Profile, and he's going to be talking about his life of faith, his journey, and you can also hear about his recent transition to becoming the principal of the London School of Theology, no less. He was, of course, up till recently, head of evangelism at the Evangelical Alliance. Next week on Unbelievable, well, it's abortion round two. Why are we doing abortion again, having done it just about a month ago? Well, because I felt that actually we needed to do a second round. For one thing, some people did think that the last time we tackled this topic, the guests were not evenly matched. Also, we didn't really get to one of the key issues that I do want to address on the next show, which is the issue of disability in particular. So we're going to be asking about the comments that Richard Dawkins made over the summer when he said, abort it and try again, as his advice to a woman asking about whether she should give birth to a baby with Down syndrome. James Mumford will be joining me next week. He's a writer and ethicist, and he's written an article for Premier Christianity magazine, which I edit, in which he compares the practice of aborting disabled babies to eugenics, no less. Well, he's going to be in conversation with Anne Furedi. She is the chief executive of BPAS, that's the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, which offers abortion as part of its services, and she believes women have a right to abortion for any reason, including disability of the baby that they're carrying. So that's going to be a very interesting debate, and probably somewhat more evenly matched as well. So I do hope you enjoy that, if enjoy is the right word, but I hope it certainly gets you thinking on next week's programme. For now, let's get into the final part of today's discussion on animal suffering.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So finally, concluding our discussion today on animal suffering, we've been asking whether the existence of death and suffering down the ages in the animal kingdom is evidence against a good creator God. Well, we started out by talking about whether generally there could be ways in which God could allow for suffering and death as part of his ultimate purposes in creating humankind and so on. We've moved on in the last section of the programme to the more specific question about whether animals feel the same kind of pain that humans do. And that's brought us on to talking about prefrontal cortexes and blind sight and all other manner of things. And if you didn't follow it all and you'd like to listen again, perhaps you're listening this Saturday afternoon, you're saying, I didn't catch all that much of that, Justin. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable if you want to listen back to the programme. And if you're a dedicated listener on the iPod or whatever, then you can just cycle back to it and catch up again. But we're going to be posting some resources from both my guests today with the programme if you want to carry out some investigations of your own. I can't recommend sticking anything in your eye, though. That wouldn't be a good idea. Let's talk about this, what Michael was saying, sure, though, in that last section, Phil. Okay.
So can I talk about the lobotomy?
Talk about lobotomies, then. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
I think we've been missold this story about the lobotomy pain. And Michael's not the only philosopher who has talked about this. But I went and dug up some of the original research on this. It was done a long time ago. Mm. And what you find is that it's not the case that lobotomy patients sort of didn't dislike pain. What they had was... their anxiety about their pain was what was reduced.
Okay.
So I'll just quote you. This was in Frontal Lobe Surgery and Treatment of Intractable Pain. This goes back to 51. It says, it's a common observation.
Your regular bedtime reading, yeah. I can tell.
It said, it's a common observation that boring, deep, all-pervading pain is in abeyance after operation, whereas lancinating attacks resulting from internal cramps or motion of a partially paralyzed leg persist. And one of Michael's sources, I've got his book, and he's referred to someone called Roger Trigg. And Trigg has a whole chapter about this. And what Trigg says is that what he thinks was going on, is their acute pain is just as bad, if not worse, as before. But it's their chronic pain. Mm. That's the sort of pain that goes on for a long time. Like if you have cancer, it's a constant pain. Mm. And a lot of people have anxiety about their pain. What does this pain mean for me? Mm-hmm. And the people that had a lobotomy were people who were especially anxious. Right. And then what happened after the operation is they lost their anxiety about their pain. And that's what they meant when they said the pain doesn't bother me. So I'll just quote you Trigg. He said, the operation diminishes their anxiety, but does not lessen their pain.
Yeah. And that's an important distinction, I suppose. But does that go back to this thing about the emotions are the ultimate thing that's important? It's whether you are... you feel emotionally bad about the pain you're experiencing. I mean, I know that some women who go through labour say, I didn't mind the pain because I knew what was coming.
In fact, that's an interesting point because cognition can often override pain. And in fact, the area of the brain is the prefrontal cortex, which can often override pain. So I used to do long distance running and it hurts, and you say, I must have the mental ability to override the pain. And it could be, of course, that animals lacking this cognitive capacity, their pain could be much, much worse because they don't have this mental attitude of, I'm giving birth to a baby, so this is the greater joy.
Okay, so it could even make it worse in that sense.
Yes, it could.
Okay,
yes.
Any responses to these issues, Michael, here?
Well, that part's true. It could be. And again, I think that's one of the things that follows from the extent of our ignorance about this. We don't know whether it's better or worse. And, for the purposes, so I don't agree. Reading the first person reports of people who were lobotomized for chronic pain, I actually don't agree with Trigg's interpretation of it. But that's, that's neither here nor there. I think what,
You did quote Trigg to support your case, no?
Yes, that's right. But I think when you look at the actual reports of the patients who were describing their condition after being lobotomized, it's hard to understand what those mental states are like. Mm. When you have disruptions of certain regions of the brain, it looks like nociception, that is, perception of pain, is still possible. But the qualitative character of that pain is hard to discern. But I know we're getting close to the end of our time, so let me say this. Mm. You might ask me, Michael, do you think non-human animals experience pain and suffering?
Let
and
me
I think
ask
the answer
you that.
Is yes, they do. I think they do.
Okay.
But if you ask me, but how confident are you in that judgment? I'd say, given all that I know about the neuroscientific, neuroanatomical, and psychological data about ourselves, my degree of confidence in it isn't as high as it is in other things. Mm. Now, one of the things that I've been accused of is therefore supporting people who want to engage in acts of animal cruelty. And if that's what people believe, they really should look at the last part of that chapter where I address that criticism in detail, because I think that none of this supports mistreatment of animals. Sure. Because I think any such creature deserves the benefit of the doubt. Mm. If you're uncertain about whether or not these organisms are capable of feeling pain and suffering, of course you treat them as if they do.
Yes.
And even if they don't, I think they shouldn't be mistreated, at least as a theist, because sure. they're creatures of God and their organismal integrity needs to be respected. So, I do think here's what I think. In the book, I said this is a conversation starting book. I don't mean to settle all the questions, sure. and I think Phil and I can agree on the fact that I didn't settle all the questions. But I think just the conversation we've had here points out that this actually is a very fertile yeah. area of discussion yeah. as we think about the problem of evil and the nature of animals. And I hope more people will continue to explore it because I do think it's I do think it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's been fabulous having you on to guide us through some of the reasoning you've had in exploring this area and why you think there is a fertile ground to be had here. Obviously, you ultimately, the reason you came to me and sort of the videos you produced were in response to the way sure. William Lane Craig used that, and you obviously feel that he didn't adequately represent what Michael has said in the book and so on, and you didn't feel it. but, I mean, if this were settled satisfactorily so that there was enough evidence to show that at some level animals do experience a different qualitative type of pain to humans, would that for you help in any way in the argument, you know, your own sort of belief in God? Or is it just, in a sense, just a very tiny part of a much bigger puzzle for you? I guess is what I'm wondering.
Okay, so before I answer that, I just want to come back on one quick
Go
thing.
Go on then.
All right. The problem is in Michael's book, he does say, thus, the evidence available to us would tend to indicate that the affective side of pain is not experienced by organisms other than humans and humanoid primates. So I think it would have been legitimate to say, here's a possibility, and I'm not endorsing it. But once you say something like that, it looks like you are endorsing it. And that's why we've had other people sort of say this sort of thing. And now to answer your question, if animal pain is slightly different, I mean, I think everyone's pain is slightly different. There's been recent studies, Horizon on BBC just had this on this week, saying that women experience pain worse than men. Right. So everyone's pain is slightly different. And we certainly don't want to try and say that the conscious experience of animals is identical to humans, because that wouldn't even make sense, because each human's experience is different. You know, I have a friend of mine who was in the SAS, and he has very, very high tolerance to pain. And he does things I could never do. So we all have a different... The question is, do they suffer?
Yes.
And the answer is yes. And that brings up a lot of problems, I think, for the theist. Because if you go back at the old Unbelievable episodes, they're really great. Go and listen to them about the problem of suffering, and listen to those defenses that Richard Swinburne came up with, that Clay Jones came up with. They cannot work for the animal suffering before the fall. And also, if you look at the sort of cruelty that's in the Bible, you know, the slaughter of the Canaanites, look at the defenses that people use against that and ask yourself, what about the bit where it says kill all their animals? Because now those defenses, you know, such as, well, those people are evil, they deserve to be slaughtered, that cannot work for the animals. So as long as they suffer at all, I think the theist has a very serious problem.
Okay. All right. Michael, any final word before we close out today's program?
I agree this is a very serious problem. That's why I devoted as much time as I did to writing a book on it. And I think there are some suggestive solutions there. I will say, you know, you mentioned Richard Swinburne's work, and Swinburne actually has a number of different things to say about animal suffering, one of which is that he thinks that their capacity to feel pain and suffering allows them to engage in actions of moral nobility. So a mother protecting her child from her offspring from the predator gives that animal a kind of creaturelinobility that it wouldn't have if nothing was at risk in providing that sort of protection. I actually think that's a pretty ennobling view of animals.
Another show to discuss that one.
You would.
I think.
I think what we've shown just in the course of this hour is there are still lots of issues to be discussed here, and the case is by no means closed on either side. So I encourage those who are listening to continue the hard work, because I think it needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, we'll certainly post a link to your book from today's program. So Michael Murray, my guest today, his book he's published a number, but the one relevant to today's discussion, Nature Red in Tooth and Claw, Theism and the Problem of Animal Suffering. So go to premierchristianradio.com/ Unbelievable for the link to today's show where you can find that. And of course, I'll make sure there are some links to where you can find Skydive Phil's material as well. That's the name you go under on YouTube. You seem a very adventurous type of person. You've talked already about going down into volcanoes, yeah. But I suspect the skydiving thing is because you do skydiving as well.
That's right. It's an old joke. How do you know there's a skydiver at a party? They'll tell you. So that's kind of what it's about.
So, well, in between skydiving and climbing into volcanoes, perhaps we'll hear from you again at some point. And thank you for bringing the whole issue to my attention. It's been a really interesting area to look into and devote a program to today. So thanks for coming in, Phil. And thank you, Michael, for being with us as well.
All right, it's been a pleasure interacting with both of you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Justin.
And if you want to give your say on today's issue, perhaps you're an animal lover. And I wonder what kind of issues this has brought up for you. Do you think animals feel the same kind of pain as humans feel? Be interested in your view on that. And is it an objection to a good God that animals do feel pain and have experienced suffering down the ages? Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can leave your comments as well underneath today's programme online. Find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we'll be hearing some of those comments in just a moment's time as we look back at some of your thoughts about the last few weeks of programming.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thanks to all those who have been getting in touch, and we're going to hear some of your emails in just a moment's time. If you'd like to email in about today's show, as I mentioned, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can follow me on Twitter, that's @unbelievablejb, or on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, to get regular updates about the show and articles that I find interesting. I also sometimes post up articles there from the Premier Christianity magazine, which I edit, and if you're interested in getting hold of a copy of that for free, then you can go to premierchristianity.com and request your free sample copy of the magazine. We're always aiming to include interesting, provocative articles, but also stuff that really helps Christians think through their faith in the way that we try to help you do that here on Unbelievable. That's premierchristianity.com. Also, a good place to go before we get some of your emails, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. We're now able to ship you out the Unbelievable DVD and CD from this year's conference. So if you're looking for 13 hours or more of audio and video from the Apologetics Conference that took place in London this year in July, go there to order your copy. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. So last week we hosted a discussion on what's got evangelicals interested in the Orthodox Church. My special guest in studio was Bishop Angelos of the Coptic Church here in the UK. We also had on the line joining us Elaine Storkey, representing a sort of Anglican evangelical position, and of course Andrew Walker as well, who was coming as an Eastern Orthodox convert. Well, here's Bex White in London, who says, thank you for another great show. Rather than the usual brain-tangling apologetics, which I do enjoy, it was a refreshing change to hear about a part of the body of Christ I know nothing about in a context of peaceful discussion. Amidst so much bad news in general and persecution of the church, I'm encouraged by this and by the Protestant response to Pope Francis. After so many schisms, might we be moving towards seeing Jesus' prayer answered, that we may be one? Not sure if you've covered it already, but I'd love to hear a discussion about the prosperity gospel. Having grown up in its shadow, I found myself increasingly convinced of its incompatibility with the Old and New Testament. It'd be interesting to hear it defended in the context of a debate rather than proclaimed from a pulpit. Bex, something that I would love to do, actually. The problem is that very few people who defend what might be called a prosperity gospel would be prepared to call it a prosperity gospel. And when I have made moves to have that kind of a discussion on the show, it's always proved difficult actually to get someone in who's willing to defend it on those terms. But anyway, we'll see what we can do. Here's what I mentioned earlier. John and his backhanded compliment. Really enjoying this programme. Much higher quality than normal. I'll forgive you that one, John, but you say Elaine Storkey is a very wise woman. Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Here's Chemnitz, who wants to say, just finished listening to the show on evangelicals and orthodoxy. Very interesting and thoughtfully handled. You always moderate well. I appreciate your inter-Christian dialogues and resonated with many of the things the guests said. I admire that the various arms of the Orthodox Church have managed to preserve the beauty of the liturgy against the encroachments of modernity. I also shared their pain when hearing about evangelicals attempting to convert them as though they weren't Christians. I have to say, though, it was a bit of a softball toss, as we say, across the pond. The only real contentious issue was that of atonement theory. The discussion was civil, but unfortunately the brief mention of the atonement as forensic justification was rather shabbily dismissed by Andrew Walker when saying it sounded like anyone could have done it, and quoting a priest saying, "I wonder if a monkey would have sufficed." Seriously? There are deep scriptural reasons for the atonement as forensic justification that would take an entire show to discuss, and you have done in the past. It didn't just come from Augustine and Anselm, as was asserted. I would have liked to hear a little more contention on this point from a non-Orthodox Church guest. And also, you want to suggest that we do a discussion on Lutheranism, have a Lutheran guest on the show. You say it would be great to continue the discussion with Reverend William Whedon as the conversation partner, currently Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church in the Missouri Synod of the U.S. He's someone who almost left his calling as a Lutheran pastor to join the Orthodox Church, has a very interesting story. Thank you very much. And you suggest Reformation Sunday as a good day to do that. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to arrange it in time for that, but appreciate the suggestion, Chemnitz. Here's Kate, who says, well, I didn't get to your email last week, Kate, and you asked if I'd received it. I did receive it, and I'm going to read it. But you also wanted to say of last week's programmes, congratulations to Premier in rerunning Priestland's Progress, a brilliant idea. Priestland's Progress is the classic BBC series that we've been rerunning between 1 and 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon for the last few weeks. You say that you also enjoyed last week's Unbelievable on the Orthodox tradition and the interview that followed it with Philip Yancey. The only snag was I ended up glued to the radio for 4 solid hours. Anyway, glad you enjoyed all of the programming on Faith Explored last week, Kate. You wanted to talk, though, about the debate that we held the week before, and that was on Paschal's Wager, an updated version of it, with Kevin Moore presenting from his book Untrumpable with our atheist guest Norman Bachrach. Well, you say, as a Christian, it was strange to find myself in broad agreement with Norman, your atheist guest, and unconvinced by Kevin, your Christian philosopher. I appreciate Kevin's intention was to reduce the argument to its simplest logical form in order to present a compelling case for the wisdom of belief in God. However, I wondered if his reasoning served to misrepresent God's character in the process. The Christian tradition teaches that before God is love, power, mercy, or anything else, he is truth. Can we impress a God of truth with attempts to believe something we actually do not believe as a way of hedging our bets in the event of an afterlife? I also take issue with Kevin's notion of a just and severely retributive God. Isn't this a contradiction in terms? Justice implies a proportionate response, whereas severe retribution suggests gratuitous revenge. I suppose we might fear and even obey such a God, but to echo Norman's point, could we love and worship him? Norman's assertion that morally good behaviour can be exhibited by people of no religious faith, including himself, is clearly true. However, believers would claim the source of the golden rule, conscience, compassion, etc., to be God, whether this is acknowledged or not. Also true, but possibly harder to quantify, is the strengthened moral purpose and changed lives, attested to by many who have come to faith. To quote Evelyn Waugh, asked how he reconciled being so horrible with being a Christian, he replied, "If I were not a Christian, I would be even more horrible." In any case, it's surely a complete distortion of the purpose of the church to regard it as some sort of club for good people. The Christian faith is not about accumulating sufficient good deeds, nor about struggling to conform to an approved set of beliefs in order to win a place in heaven. It's primarily about humility. It involves a recognition of the infinite chasm between imperfect man and a perfect God. At best, we may achieve the status of small-time sinners rather than big-time sinners, but the gap between all of us and God and our need for his forgiveness is exactly the same. Okay, thank you very much. You finish by saying the good news of the gospel is that whilst our own efforts are doomed to failure, it is God himself who is able to bridge the gap between heaven and earth. In his son, Jesus Christ, he has crossed infinity to save us. Preach it, Kate. And finally, Hung Wai, long-time fan of your show, says, Hung Wai. Followed every episode on podcast ever since discovering on the airwaves by chance over 4 years ago. I'm usually impressed, but I feel somewhat let down and frustrated by some of your atheist guests recently. It started off with James Croft, who absolutely refused to engage with the argument. Now, just as a note, this was when he came on to discuss with Callum Miller about whether God is the best explanation for the nature of our universe. And you says you felt he failed to even acknowledge the problem of induction until the end of the show, where he dismissed it because it wasn't a practical problem. It seems he doesn't even understand the issue, despite claiming to have studied philosophy. I've heard him on your show before, and even engaged with him directly in a few forum exchanges. He's extremely talented at hand-waving and evasion. Please don't have him on the show again. And then you say you're disappointed with Mara Clark in the abortion discussion, and the same with Norman Backrack, who, despite being a prominent atheist philosopher, refused to acknowledge the terms of Pascal's wager. Now, I don't think Norman would himself describe himself as a prominent atheist philosopher. He's written a bit on philosophy, but he's never held a post or anything like that, so we might shrink away from that moniker. But in any case, you say, overall, if the quality of the atheists are like this, what does it say for the future of atheism? I think you ought to penalise guests like this by no longer inviting them back on the show. I don't mean to be so harsh. Any criticism I have expressed is at your guests. I still think you do a good job of hosting the show. And I was actually very impressed with Julian Bagini. Even though I disagree with his position, he was very reasonable and rational in how he explained things. It would be nice to hear more from him. And you also appreciated the shows with Salim Manoia and Steve Maltz. Probably one of the best episodes in your show recently, you say. Would love to hear more from those two, if possible. Okay, thank you very much for getting in touch with your thoughts as well. There's been quite a lot of talk in the press in the last week or two about life after death, near-death experiences and so on. This is after the release of a major new scientific study on accounts of near-death experiences, the AWARE project, and Derek wants to bring this to my attention as well. Apparently the first paper has been published. The most intriguing part of this study was that they were putting pictures high up in resuscitation rooms, because of the reports of unconscious people seeing down onto themselves while their spirit, soul or whatever was floating free up near the ceiling. So if there really were disembodied events happening, then people might see these pictures and be able to recall them. You go on to say that, disappointingly, there were only 101 events that could be studied, and only two had some sort of awareness while supposedly unconscious, and neither of these were in areas with the pictures. But you'd like to hear more detail about these cases studied. And indeed, we're planning on doing a couple of shows, actually, reflecting on near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences and the like, especially in regard to this recent major study that's been released recently. Excited to say that we've got a show lined up with Eben Alexander. He published the New York Times best-selling book, A Proof of Heaven, and he's a neurosurgeon who underwent a sort of near-death experience when he was brain dead, but claims to have had extraordinary revelations of the afterlife. He'll be coming on the show soon to discuss that with a skeptic, and we've got other things in the pipeline as well. So I hope that satisfies that particular question for you, Derek, and I'm looking forward to that as well. A really interesting area to delve into a bit. Thank you for listening as well, and if you come back again at the same time next week, well, let me tell you what you can look forward to then.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be debating abortion again, and this time my guests are going to be James Mumford and Anne Furedi. Well, James Mumford is a writer and ethicist, and he's written an article for a forthcoming edition of Premier Christianity magazine, looking at Richard Dawkins' comments about aborting disabled babies, specifically Down syndrome. Well, he compares the practice of aborting disabled babies to eugenics. And so James is going to be in conversation with Anne Furedi of BPAS, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, which offers abortion services. And she believes very much that women have the right to abort a baby, really for any reason they wish to, including disability. So that should be a very interesting and exciting discussion at the same time next week. I hope you can join us too. And don't forget, you can find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. For now, I'll say goodbye and leave you in the hands of the profile. Today's guest is going to be Krish Kandiah.